and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, crypto is raging again. Stocks are near record highs, thanks to just a handful of companies, really. And Tesla's market cap has surged past the $1 trillion mark. It really makes you think, do we have to worry about being in a bubble again? Well, we'll get into it with one of the best-known experts in fundamental investing. But first, Valdana, I have to ask you about your adventure in NFT land this week. I know they actually allowed you to turn your computer off for once. I think it's the first time your computer's been off in about 18 months or so.
Yeah, a year and a half.
A year and a half. And you literally stopped typing, and they let you go to the NFT non-fungible token conference in New York. What was that like?
Yeah, it was my first conference where I actually was with other people, because I've been to a bunch of, you know, virtual conferences over the last couple of months. But it was strange to be around people, first of all. But second of all, the main event really was the after parties after the conference. Right. And I hadn't realized that going in. So there were like 20 or 30 or some crazy amount of parties, and everybody was just party hopping afterwards and talking about NFTs and cryptos and all kinds of stuff.
I think that's the deal with all crypto conferences. It's just some whatever panel and then some big nightclub spectacle.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea going in. So, you know, I got invites to parties for the first time in my life.
First time in your life. I doubt that.
And then wish you here as our guest. Let's bring him in. Valdana, introduce our guest.
Yeah, I'm so happy to have Rob Arnott join us. He's the founder and chairman of Research Affiliates. Thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, it's a privilege.
And Rob, you're in Austin, I believe, right? You're getting some traveling this week. Is that right?
I have been on one of my first business trips in the last 18 months and visited Arizona and Texas. And I have a couple of sons in Austin, so I'm spending the weekend here.
Oh, good. Enjoy. Rob, I want to bring you in on that notion of bubbles. I was reading one of the slide deck I think you had as a presentation recently, where maybe it was just on your website, I'm not sure. But I was sort of fascinated by one slide in the deck. You say, when talking about the notion of bubbles, you say, we offer a simple two-part definition. One, if we're using a valuation model, for example, a discounted cash flow model, we must make implausibly optimistic assumptions in order to justify prices. And then number two is the marginal buyer doesn't care about valuation models. I wonder, to me, number two seems to be usually the case when you enter bubble territories. People just turn off the logic. They turn off sort of, you turn these models off or just ignore them. Is that your opinion of what usually happens? And are we seeing any signs of that right now?
Of course, we're seeing signs of that. And when it comes to people ignoring valuation models, that is characteristic of bubbles. That's there really as a cross-check on the first one. I mean, there are people who will say, gosh, you'd have to make implausible assumptions about Microsoft to justify its current market cap. Okay, maybe, but is the marginal buyer an unsophisticated investor who doesn't care about valuation? Hardly. And so you can readily scratch that off the list. With Apple, you don't even have to make implausible assumptions. You just have to make moderately aggressive assumptions, and you can easily justify the price. When it comes to things like Tesla and Zillow and Netflix, you have to make very, very, very aggressive assumptions. I debated Kathy Wood about a month ago at Morningstar conference, and I asked her, what's your valuation model that would justify a target price of $3,000? And she said, well, that's simple. It's going to grow 89% a year for the next 5 years. And at the end of the 5 years, it'll be valued at the same multiples as today's FANG stocks. And I was thinking at the time, I'd been asked to play nice, but I was thinking at the time, you know, 89% a year for 5 years, that is 25-fold growth. So is she really saying it'll be 25 times as large in just 5 years as it is today? Amazon, the biggest growth story of a generation, grew 14-fold in the last 10 years. So tacitly, she's assuming twice Amazon's growth in half as many years. That's really aggressive. So when I hear numbers like that, I think, okay, that's implausible. And therefore, it's potentially bubble territory. How many people use a valuation model to justify buying? Hardly anyone. And so that qualifies for the definition.
Well, Rob, just I'm going to pull Mike Regan here and ask you a multi-part question. But I was re-listening to the episode the last time you were on this podcast, and I believe you had mentioned the Tesla example, and I think you had said in the market we're seeing micro bubbles all the time. And correct me if I got the term wrong. And then I was looking through one of your slide decks that you had put together recently, and you had said something like, you know, what is an anti-bubble? So I'm hoping you can describe to us what you see going on, what you might consider a bubble or a micro bubble, and what exactly is an anti-bubble?
Well, firstly, micro bubbles are single asset bubbles. Tesla, if you buy into the notion that it's a bubble, as we do, is a micro bubble. It's just one asset. Tech, is it a bubble? Nope. Tech, there's lots of companies where people use valuation models to justify buying. You have to make aggressive assumptions to collectively justify today's tech weighting in the indexes, but you don't have to use implausible assumptions. So it's not quite like the tech bubble of 2000 in that regard. Anti-bubbles are markets or investments where you would have to make implausibly pessimistic assumptions in order to not earn a decent return. So let me give you an example. State-owned enterprises in China and Russia. The narrative is, don't buy these. These are state-owned. The state has the right and the power to expropriate your wealth at will. And you could put money there and get nothing. Absolutely true. Like most narratives, that's true. But if they want continued access to global capital, the likelihood is they'll continue the current dividends. They'll increase them with the growth of the economy. And you won't get much more than that. Okay, what's the yield on SOEs in China and Russia? It's about 5%. If it grows with inflation, let alone growing with the economy, that's a 5% real return. Our work suggests that real returns in bond markets around the world are negative, and in stock markets in the U.S., barely positive. So is a 5% real return pretty good? Yeah, you'd have to make implausible assumptions not to justify buying. And does the marginal seller care about valuation models? No, they're selling because of the narrative. They know they're cheap.
So if you're in either a bubble or an anti-bubble, and you this notion that the marginal buyer seller just is ignoring the valuation models, at least that's part of it. I mean, I'm guessing eventually, you know, what happens is something sort of, you know, shakes people up and you sort of revert to caring about valuations again. And correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but, you know, to me, the main candidate that would do that in this instance, a lot of people would claim would be the Fed changing policy. And we did get a little hint this week, or more than a hint, you know, the Fed is basically coming out and saying they do plan to taper asset purchases. Is that enough to do it? Or, you know, is the policy still for the foreseeable future so loose that it shouldn't really sort of slap some sense back into the market right away?
Catalyst question is a fun one. Because whatever the catalyst is, it's got to come as a surprise to the market. And what the market is unsurprised by is already baked into the price. So Fed tapering, no, that's not a catalyst because it's totally expected. But it is a fun parlor game to guess what the catalyst could be. Rising interest rates in the years ahead. If that happens, there's a narrative out there that says growth stocks are worth a lot of money because you're discounting future growth at a very low rate, well below the growth rate. And so the value of future growth goes through the roof. No wonder these stocks are expensive. Well, it turns out if you go back historically and ask, did changes in real rates affect the relative performance of growth and value? The answer is no. It's a random relationship. There is no evident linkage in the data. So when you have a narrative that says growth stocks are soaring because interest rates are falling, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy until it doesn't. And if it's a narrative that is incorrect, the self-fulfilling prophecy is a self-fulfilling prophecy that is in error, creating an inefficiency, creating a mispricing, creating an opportunity. So I look at that and I think, well, one catalyst for FANG-type stocks to take a hit would be rising interest rates. Another catalyst would be, gosh, these companies have done awfully well, partly because of COVID. Most of them are extraordinarily well positioned for a world with a pandemic. Most of them are well positioned for the aftermath of the pandemic because behaviors will change in their favor. Well, that's good. But by the same token, I love to ask the question, what problems are we facing today that we'll be facing still in 5 years, and what are going to be irrelevant in 5 years? Is COVID going to be stalking the world as a lethal death machine 5 years from now? No, we'll have global herd immunity by then. It'll still kill people, but not in vast numbers. Is our supply chain disruptions going to be wreaking havoc with global economy 5 years from now? No, no. I mean, that's a perfect example of the kind of thing that a healthy economy figures out a fix reasonably quickly. Are demographics still going to be an issue 5 years from now? My goodness, yes. How often do you hear the media talking about demography? Are debt and deficit going to be an issue 5 years from now? My goodness, yes. And so it helps you focus on which relationships, which narratives deserve attention and which may just be roiling markets creating opportunities for you to contra trade.
I want to take us back to something Mike mentioned in your introduction, which is that we're being pulled higher by just a handful of stocks. And I know it's something you focus a lot on and you've written about this quite a bit. So I'm hoping you could break down for us like what the concerns are around that. And then maybe you slightly hinted at the next part of my question, which is something we don't really hear about very frequently, which is what actually might make that trend come apart, if that makes sense. So under what would need to happen for the big five to not be pulling stocks higher all the time?
Well, firstly, plain old gravity can come into play. I'm often asked what finished off the tech bubble in the year 2000. I have yet to hear a really compelling catalyst that could have caused the tech bubble to burst other than gravity. And so part of it may just be gravity. Now, you got to be careful with bubbles because they can go far longer and carry much further than anyone might expect. My favorite example is the Zimbabwe stock market during their hyperinflation in 2008. As you came into summer, you might have said, this country's got hyperinflation. It's a mess. Not only do I want to not own that stock market, I'm going to short sell it. But I don't know much about it, so I'm going to short sell 2% of my net worth. Well, over the next 6 weeks, their currency fell tenfold and their stock market went up 500-fold, which means in US dollar terms, 50-fold, which means your 2% short position just cost you 100% of your net worth. 8 weeks later, the currency had fallen another 100-fold and the stock market basically went to zero and stopped trading. So you were right, but bankrupt. Be very careful about bubbles. Now, we look at the FANGs. We actually broaden it to include Apple and Microsoft, the big winners from the first tech bubble. And what we find is those six companies, which we refer to as the FAN mags, are worth more than the top five companies in the S&P 500. Why? Because the top five are all in the FAN mags. Five of the six are the top five companies in the S&P. This level of concentration has not been seen since the late 40s or early 50s. And what's interesting is the total value of these six companies is approximately $8.5 trillion. All right, that's just a really big number. How do we put it into a context? Well, the entire stock market of Japan is $6 trillion. So you could buy Japan for these six companies. The three largest economies in Europe, Germany, France, and the UK, with collectively nearly 200 million citizens, worth less than the FAN mags. So I look at that and I think, gosh, that seems awfully stretched. And so I view that as kind of classic bubble territory. But like I said, bubbles can go on for a long time and can carry a long way.
This is not a totally serious question, but you mentioned FAN mags, and I know on Twitter there were so many jokes after Facebook changed its name to Meta. I don't know if you guys are reconsidering a new acronym.
No. May want to replace Netflix with Tesla, which would turn it into Fat Mag, but never mind that.
That has a nice ring to it, Fat Mag. Yeah. So for listeners who aren't familiar with Research Affiliates, I mean, a lot of your pioneering work is fundamental indexing, weighting an index based on the true fundamentals of a company rather than just a market cap index like the S&P 500. But with so many investors just going passively into an S&P 500 fund, regardless of the collected wisdom of fundamental indexing, does it just make it such an uphill task to go against that flow? You know what I mean? And is it, speaking of self-fulfilling prophecies, does it just, it's hard to take the other side of that trade is what I'm saying, with so much money flowing right into market cap. How do you think about that?
Here's a couple of observations. Firstly, every $1 billion flowing into index funds, and there's a lot of billions of dollars flowing into index funds, involves $200 million moved from non-S&P members to S&P members, size weighted or market cap weighted, hence favoring the largest cap stocks, which tend to be underweighted in most active portfolios. So you're going to have $200 billion flow into large cap and out of non-members of the index. So there have been those in academia who try to quantify what's the valuation gap difference of being a member versus a non-member. And it's pretty large. Now, here's another factoid that's just fascinating. Stocks that are added to the S&P are companies that have just recently soared. They're popular, they're beloved. The index committee is embarrassed that they don't have it in the index yet. Let's fix that. And what do they replace? A company that's in free fall, unloved, where the index committee is embarrassed that it is in the index. Tesla and AIV are beautiful case study in that. Now, what happens to the stocks that are added? Tesla's an outlier. On average, they underperform the market by 1-2% in their first year. Not much, but underperform. The stocks that are deleted from the index on average beat the market by 2,000 basis points, 20 percentage points in the first year after they're deleted. Now, that means that if you wanted to create a better index fund, you could just invest in the S&P, and then when S&P changes the index, write it down on a post-it note, stick it on your fridge, look at it a year later and say, okay, now I'll do the trade. That kind of utterly naive approach gives you S&P returns plus 18 basis points a year over the last 30 years. That's pretty cool. So indexing creates inefficiencies that can be easily exploited, that can create interesting investment opportunities.
So you and I actually talked about this, I think it was over the summer, so a couple of months ago, and it was about Tesla's addition, and you had done some research showing that really large companies that are added to an index tend to lag. You just mentioned Tesla. Tesla is an outlier. So what is your thinking around this one? Because it did just have one of its best months in the last year and a half, and it was one of the biggest advancers in the S&P 500 in the month of October. So how are you thinking about it?
Well, stocks, whether expensive or inexpensive, go up and down. They just do. You can have cheap stocks that go get cheaper. You can have expensive stocks that get more expensive. And like I said, bubbles can go further than anyone could possibly imagine. It's interesting, when we last spoke, Tesla was roughly flat from its being added to the index, but the market was up about 20%. So it was behind the market. And AIV, Apartment Investments, a tiny company that's a REIT for apartments. My God, have you seen how apartment rents have soared? Okay. AIV, a company that is a REIT specializing in apartments, was up 60% when we last spoke. Now, think what's happened to rents around the country in the last year. That's a solid foundation for the rebound in price. And so it was 60% ahead of Tesla at the time. It's still ahead of Tesla. It's still gone up more than Tesla has. And so when we look at these patterns of behavior, when we look at the way indexing roils the markets, one of the strangest narratives coming out of the indexing world is we don't move prices. Well, they say that because a stock is added and the price doesn't move when they add it. Okay, that's because it already moved. Tesla was up 47% between the date it was announced and the date it was added. Why didn't some index funds buy it when it was announced in anticipation of it going up? They've got the world very well trained that any tracking error, any mismatch between their performance and the market index is a sign of sloppiness or even incompetence. And so they zero in on the actual price at which the stock will come into the index. How do they do that? They enter a block trade that is a market on close trade. Market on close means buy it whatever the price is. No price limit. Market prices, anything goes. And at on close means I want this to be part of the closing price transaction. So well over $100 billion of Tesla changed hands in one block trade at the close of December 18 of last year. All right. Well, that's kind of interesting. Why would you do a market trade to lock in the price? Not to lock in the best price, to lock in the exact price at which the stock is entering the S&P 500. Kind of interesting. Yeah. The S&P, don't get me wrong, S&P has done a wonderful favor for the world by creating the world's first and largest index fund that the normal retail investor could buy. They have shaken up the active management arena by demonstrating that the average active manager doesn't win. Doesn't mean that active managers can't win, but an active manager wins only if there's a loser on the other side of their trades. And if you ask most active managers, who's the loser on the other side of your trade? They don't have a clue. If they don't have a clue, they probably don't have value add.
Rob, I wanted to, before we get to our crazy things of the week, I wanted to ask you about one of the scatter plots I saw in a recent report of yours was kind of showing where, you know, the attractive expected returns are. And I couldn't help but notice emerging market value seems to screen very well on both axes. And I'll have to describe it to the chart to readers. You know, you've got your expected return and your expected volatility on the x-axis. I know it's not the first time EM equities have screened attractively, right? I mean, they kind of always do. And I'm wondering if those, you know, if the one axis is ruining the fun on the other axis. In other words, is that expected volatility so much that it for investors thinking about risk-adjusted returns that they just stay away from it, and then you don't get the expected return that it's screening for? Is there a relationship there, do you think?
The relationship is actually more in the camp of behavioral finance, and that is market prices are set based on narratives, based on, think of it as memes. Widely accepted opinions that are shared to an extent that it creates the price. Now, the narrative in 2008 was emerging markets are emerging, and you have the Arab Spring, and you have rapid growth as far as the eye can see. And so, of course, you should pay more for an emerging markets portfolio than for U.S. stocks. You're going to have higher growth. And so the emerging markets index was priced at 38 times the valuation, the 38 times its 10-year smoothed earnings. So think of that as a sustainable earnings base. The U.S. was at 28 times pre-crash. And so it was a 40% premium to the U.S. Where is it now? It's 15 times. The U.S. is at 38. It's a 60% discount. So the question is, what's a fair relative valuation? The fair relative valuation when everybody thought there were no clouds on the horizon was a 40% premium. The fair valuation when everybody thinks the emerging markets are bumbling towards oblivion is 60% discount. Now, once again, think about a five-year look ahead. The narrative is these countries are not well prepared for COVID. The death rates are way higher. They don't even know how many have died, but the numbers bound to be at least twice the reported numbers. And they roll out the vaccine slowly. So this is going to be a big problem for them. And by the way, do supply chain disruptions do more harm to us or to the emerging economies that depend on delivering these goods to the developed world? So these are terrible headwinds. 5 years from now, they're immunized. There is no major problem with COVID. Supply chain disruptions are dealt with. So now what's the fair relative valuation? 20% discount? Well, if so, then EM is going to double. That's cool. Now, what about value? The spread between growth and value in emerging markets is an 8-to-1 ratio. That is to say, the valuation multiples of their high flyers is 8 times the valuation multiples of their value stocks.
Wow.
An 8-to-1 ratio. So what happens if that returns to the normal 4-to-1 ratio? Well, value doubles relative to growth. And that also means that value on a standalone basis beats the market by another 40%. So now instead of doubling, now you're up 180%. Yeah. And if you're up 180% over the next 10 years, this is not Tesla at 89% growth. this is just modest increments, a few hundred basis points from this, a few hundred basis points from that, and you can pretty quickly get to double-digit returns on a 10-year look-ahead basis. I'm happy to invest in something that's got high odds of double-digit 10-year returns.
And I'm sort of inferring that you would put China's regulatory crackdowns in that bucket of stuff that we're probably not going to be talking about in 5 years, I guess.
Of course. Now, is China going to continue down a Maoist path? They might, but they're only one emerging economy. And in our strategy, Fundamental Index for emerging markets, China barely rates in the teens in terms of its weight. Mm-hmm. In the cap-weighted market, it's more like 30%+. So we wind up giving it a half weight anyway. And that's not because we subjectively judge Xi's policies to be wrong. It's because Chinese stocks are expensive relative to the rest of the world. So we're reweighting the value down, the growth stocks down. The bat stocks, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, they're all Chinese. Mm-hmm. The FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, they're all U.S. The tech innovation seems concentrated in these two markets.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Well, Vildana, in our strategy here on What Goes Up, we put a heavy weight on the crazy things we saw during the week. So let's start with you. What's the craziest thing you saw this week?
It's actually tied to my trip to the NFT conference, which is I went to two separate panels. There was big news from the NFT world from Quentin Tarantino, who found his old first handwritten script for Pulp Fiction and turned it into 7 secret NFTs. And so that's the craziest thing I've seen this week. And the way I understand it is if you buy the NFT, what you're buying is access to this secret content. So the NFTs are going to have commentary from him. You're going to be able to see, I guess, pages from the script, some scenes that had never been seen before. So I think you're just like unlocking secret content. And maybe our listeners can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the first time I've really heard of this secret NFT thing.
I would need, if one of the NFTs shows you what's inside the briefcase that they carry around the whole movie, then I might be a buyer. But I don't know if that's on the table.
That's the other thing about the secret NFT. We might never know, because if you buy it, and you choose to keep it a secret, you don't need to. I mean, then you are. You know.
That's like the Japanese billionaire who bought the Van Gogh Iris's painting and then instructed his executors to bury it with him. And it's never been seen since, which means one of two things. They either honored his request, or they sold it to some hedge fund billionaire in Switzerland who's got it hidden away in a vault.
Hiding behind his desk in his office. Rob, have you fallen into this crypto and NFT rabbit hole at all? Are you thinking about this stuff at all?
2013, I became aware of Bitcoin. I thought it was fascinating. As a libertarian, I thought this will give central bankers a so-called run for their money. It'll be fun to watch. And so I debated, should I put $100,000 in? Or I said, nah, I don't buy things I don't understand. I'll just buy one Bitcoin. Cost me $200-some-odd. Today it would be worth today if I bought the 100,000, it'd be worth about $25 million. Oopsie.
That's amazing. Well, at least you got one, right? You got a partial laser eye, I guess, as they say. But how about you, Rob? Have you seen anything crazy this week?
Craziest thing this week for me is back to business as normal, in-person meetings all day, every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, dinner meetings, breakfast meetings, lunch meetings, and the fun of seeing people face to face. I've done little scattered bits of that in recent weeks, but this is the first time I've done a dedicated week of travel and face to face meetings. It's in historical terms, it's not a particularly strange thing, but this week it is.
Feels good, doesn't it?
It feels wonderful.
And I know you're in Austin, so I assume you're going to stop in and see Elon Musk at the new Tesla headquarters, right?
Oh, yeah. He and I are having dinner tonight.
All right. Hopefully brisket in Austin. But I'll give you my craziest thing. And this is, I couldn't top the one I got from a listener who goes by the name Financial Gambler on Twitter. Valdana, very, very loyal listener. He's a good friend of the show, so we thank
Great
him.
Great tweets.
He's a good tweeter, yes. He pointed out on eBay, there's a iPhone X that's being auctioned on eBay, and it's the only known iPhone that has a USB port to it, a USB-C port, to be specific. You know, Apple obviously has their own, you know, the Lightning charger, whatever you call that port. So here's where we play the Price is Right, Valdana and Rob. What would you pay, or what? Not what would you pay? I know Rob's a fundamentals guy, so he probably wouldn't pay anything above list price. But what do you suppose the current bid is for this one of a kind USB port phone on eBay? Well, Donna, you go first.
I was hoping you'd ask me what I would bid, because I wouldn't bid very much, because nobody who uses USB ports anymore.
Well, it's USB-C.
Yes.
Compact.
So that's the smaller one, right? Smaller,
yeah, that port, makes a big difference.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes at least $1 million, $2 million difference in Well, I'm guessing seven figures. I'm going to guess 3.
3 million, wow. You know we're in a bubble with that kind of pricing on this. Valdana, what's your guess?
I was going to guess like $3,000.
You're a true bargain hunter. We got a pretty good spread. I will say the auction's not over, so we may get to your $3 million, Rob. Especially when our big pocketed, deep pocketed listeners hear this. Current bid $99,900, which I was surprised by. But to your point, Rob, you know, tech people like to have collectible, one of a kind things. So I could see this thing going up before the auction's actually closed.
When I see people spending $60 million for an NFT piece of art where anyone can view the art on the internet and all you have is a document that says you own it, and it's electronic, and you don't even control distribution or draw licensing fees on that, that still all goes to the artist. Then I think some stupid thing can go for $3 million.
Well, Rob, I think that's all the time we have. I hope you can get some brisket while you're in Austin. I'm drooling thinking about it. And Valdana, I don't know if you're a brisket fan, but we'll...
vegetarian.
Okay. Maybe they have tofu brisket. I don't know.
No, thank you.
Smoked tofu or something.
No, thanks.
Rob Arnott, pleasure as always to have you on the show, and hopefully we can bring you back someday. What goes up, we'll be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Valdana Heirich is at Valdana Heirich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcast. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.